You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Attention campers, the new Camp Snoopy at Kings Island brings your family summer camp fun all season long. Head to Camp Snoopy with Charlie Brown and the whole Peanuts gang for fun and adventure. Race forwards and backwards on the new family boomerang coaster, Snoopy Soapbox Racers. Explore on your own with more space to roam at Beagle Scout Acres. And don't forget to grab a snack at Pigpen's Mess Hall. It's a new way to play with the Peanuts gang at Camp Snoopy. Now open, only at Kings Island, for the fun of it.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Tim Stenovec on Bloomberg Radio.
Never give up, give it your all. Keep your eye on the ball. You gotta keep steady.
All right, you are here. We're already getting going.
Oh, we're having fun.
We are having fun. We're at the U.S. Open. And I have to say, last year, I got to watch the amazing doubles matchup between Serena and Venus, and then watching Serena's last match. And I just think about the role that those two individuals have had on the game of tennis and really at the world at large.
I got to see Venus play on Tuesday night.
You did get to see Venus play.
I mean, what's amazing about Venus is she's literally playing against people who grew up seeing her win Grand Slams. It's remarkable.
It is pretty remarkable. Who's also
She's
remarkable
been playing for a long time.
Is the woman who's sitting next to us again. Katrina Adams, former president, chairman, and CEO of the U.S. Tennis Association, chair of the U.S. Open, as well as the chair of the International Tennis Federation Cup and Gender Equality in Tennis Committees, former pro, tennis pro, double specialist, and I could go on and on and on. You're amazing.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming back and finding time. You're busy.
Always excited to be here with you guys.
Well, tell us about what you're excited about this year at the Open.
Oh, my goodness. It's the U.S. Open. It's spectacular, right?
I know. But
I mean, everything that's happening here. I mean, you know, obviously you just mentioned Venus Williams, just to see her back on the court again,
amazing.
You know, since 1994.
It's remarkable,
right? I was sitting in her box in 1997 when she played her first final and lost to Martina Hingis. I was here when she played the final against Serena, her sister, when Serena won it in 99. But, you know, when you look at the emergence of Coco Gauff and Francis Tiafoe and Jess Pegula and you know, Michael Moe, look what he did today, taking out John Isner and so many young players, Ben Shelton. It's exciting for the American players, Tommy Paul. There's so many. I can't even name them all right now. And you know, there was a time I could name them all on one hand.
Does it feel like we're sort of in a, you know, Andre Agassi, Pete Sampras, Jim Curry, or Michael Chang sort of era where we have these Americans who dominate?
No, let's not get ahead of ourselves.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that we have the ability to get there, because when you talk about Taylor Fritz and TFO in the top 10, and Tommy Paul knocking on the door, and Ben Shelton, those guys are knocking on the door, yes, we'll get there. But until they start winning majors like Pete Sampras and Andre Agassi and Jim Curry and Michael Chang, then it's a different story.
But I just
it's a long time, by the way. No, it's good, but it's a long
time
coming to be able to talk about these guys being in these majors, getting into the second weeks consistently, and then having some new names to join that on the men's side. We've always been there on the women's side.
Yeah.
But to be able to talk about these men is really exciting.
Katrina, what is it that kind of keeps a younger generation coming back to tennis?
I think being able to see players like we just mentioned on the court week in and week out, you know, and at these majors going deep to motivate the young kids to want to get into the sport. So when you talk about Fritz and Tiafoe and Paul, you know, who were they watching when they were young kids? Who motivated them to get into the sport? And for them, I think when they came up through the USTA Player Development Program, where they really got to travel together, train together, motivate one another, push one another, they're still doing that. And they were looking up to the John Isners of the world, the Jack Sox of the world, both who are retiring here. John Isner played his last singles match here, and he and Jack are playing doubles later today. This is Jack's last tournament where he'll be retiring. So I think it's generational. You know, Mike and Bob, they retired last year, 2 years ago now, Mike and Bob Ryan. And so I think, you know, each generation inspires the next generation. And it's fun to watch these brotherhoods and sisterhoods form and develop.
I still have this question about access. You know, tennis for a lot of people, it's looked at as like a country club sport still. It's very expensive to get courts in cities, especially during the winter if you live somewhere where it snows. I mean, Tiafo, for example, let's look at his story. Would he be a pro tennis player if his dad didn't work at a tennis center? I don't know if the answer to that.
He could, because he grew up in an NJTL program. So the program itself was accessible. The program itself was free. The program itself, you know, provided opportunity. I run a program like that here in Harlem, the Harlem Junior Tennis and Education Program, which provides access and opportunity for inner city youth. There are over 200 of those types of chapters, NJTL chapters around the country, in addition to after school programs. So access is available. Mm-hmm. It's not about having access. It's not about learning the sport. It's about once you develop to be a player and you become competitive, that's where the cost comes.
Okay, here's my concern. Every tennis court I see is being turned into a pickleball court.
Not every tennis court. Let's not put that out there now.
Do you play pickleball?
This is driving me crazy.
No.
Thank you. Neither do I. No, this is when you speak to a serious tennis player and you ask them about pickleball, that's the answer.
I think the challenge where you're looking at those courts are probably at clubs, because clubs are about making money.
Yeah.
So a club is looking at taking a court, one tennis court, and turn it into four pickleball courts, where they can try. Now they've got 16 players on a court versus four, right? So they're looking at the opportunity to be able to make more money. It's about monetization. But I also think, listen, I have nothing against pickleball. I think it's a great opportunity for people to get out and get exercise,
right,
to have fun, to be social. I think it's fantastic. There's a great buzz out there, but it's about longevity. Where will it go? I think it's growing.
Do you think it's a fad?
I don't want to say it's a fad, because you want all the racket sports to succeed. It's a racket sport. We are a racket sport in tennis. But what I do want is that it's done right and that people are staying healthy. It's also a sport where the highest injuries are coming, because everybody thinks they can go out and play pickleball. And they're ruining their knees and ankles, and they're falling and this and that. So I think there just has to be a little more structure to it. You know, tennis is a skilled sport and it's a mechanical sport. So is pickleball, but people aren't realizing that. And they're able to go out and learn and make, you know, hand-eye coordination quickly,
right,
without really understanding the mechanics of it or the footwork of it. And that's where they're starting to get injured.
What do you love that people talk about when it comes to tennis generally? What do you hate that they talk about?
What I love is that it's an individual sport where you can just go out and build your own self-esteem and your self-confidence, right?
Did that for you?
You're figuring it. Oh, my gosh, yes. I mean, I love to compete. I'm a natural-born competitor. So for me, it was about competing not just against you but against myself and getting better. Pushing myself to hit one extra ball, pushing myself to go one more rally, pushing myself to do one more drill, and pushing myself to get better every single day I went on the court, learning a new shot, learning a new spin. And I think that's the thrill that I had that hopefully everybody else is having. You know, I speak to a lot of older women that may not be starting until they're 40. And they're going out and they're learning at 40, 50, and they're becoming these 3.0 level players and having so much fun and just a thrill. That excites me. The fact that you could start so late and have so much fun. It's not going out there being, you know, playing here at the U.S. Open for everybody, but just to go out and have fun and build a camaraderie with people and still have a competitive drive and natural competitive drive in yourself.
So wait,
there's nothing that I hate about the sport.
Okay. So then what I want to ask you is, I'm thinking about Michelle Obama, who at the beginning of the week was talking about just equality and pay. And here we are, and you know, Tim knows we talk about this all the time, that we continue to have these conversations. And it's same thing with women in, you know, the CEO role. How do you feel about it? Why does it take so long for there to be parity with pay?
I think it's life, right? It's parity. There's no parity in pay in anything that we have. So 50 years of equal pay here at the U.S. Open, I mean, that says a lot. We finally have parity in pay at all of the Grand Slam events.
At the Open. Still,
well, or we definitely have it at the U.S. Open.
Yeah.
It was the first one.
Yeah.
50 years here. We have it at all of the Grand Slams, in Australian, Roland Garros, and Wimbledon. Wimbledon was the last one. 2002, but or 12. But when we look at the tours, and we have our joint events, and the ATP event is still getting paid more than the women at the same event, the same week,
significantly
same location.
More. Yeah,
that's where it's challenging. It's getting better, but it's about sponsorship. You know, why are we not getting the same level of sponsorship for the WTA or for the women events that the men are? And so, you know, thank God for Billie Jean King 50 years ago to go out and find a sponsor to throw in the pot to make the prize money equal here at the U.S. Open. That's because of her and Bristol Myers, who added $55,000 to the women's prize money to make it equal to the men, and then they never looked back. They realized how much of a great thing it was, and we were fortunate enough to be able to do that going forward.
What's wild to me is that it's 50 years of equal pay here at the U.S. Open, but there are so many other sports today where there's not even close to parity.
Oh, no. I mean, when you look at the women's soccer, USW...
Women's national team.
Women's national soccer team. It's crazy that just happened.
Yeah.
You know, and they fought for years when they were the better team. With their better results at World Cup,
better recognition,
right? And now, you know, now we have a professional women's hockey team. We're constantly fighting, and you look at the women's NBA, the WNBA. Not yet do they have parity, even though it's a shorter season. But just look at when you look at the amenities, they don't even have their own private jets yet.
It's crazy
to travel from game to game.
And it says something about whether people say, oh, we still think you're valuable. No, it says something about your value and your worth.
It says a lot.
Right?
And so we still have a long way to go. And it's something that we as professional athletes have been fighting for a very long time, longer than 50 years. And hopefully we can get there.
Hey, Katrina, one thing I wanted to ask you, you talked a little bit about earlier about what it took to be a professional tennis player, all the practice, you wanting, having the desire to keep going. Tennis is a sport that drives individuals completely insane. I mean, you watch some of these players on the court and they're screaming at themselves. And if you were walking down the street, so was I. If you're walking down the street and you were to see this person in the context of like the middle of the street, you would say that person actually needs help. But you see him on a tennis court and it's like totally normalized.
And you're like, I get that.
I get that. I'm wondering though, how you take that after you retire and you use that energy in your professional career, like, does that keep going, that mental toughness that you built up?
It does. And I think, you know, we build ourselves to be perfectionists in everything that we do. And so there is no room for failure, quote unquote failure, but only for improvement. So whatever we're doing and whatever profession that is, we want to be the best. And I know for a fact there are people that hire former professional tennis players or athletes because they understand winning. They know that they want to win, but they understand what losing feels like. So they want to hire them because they know that they're going to give it their all because they don't like the feeling of losing. So they know that they're going to make sure that they're successful. And so I think that is those are qualities and the life skills that we have that make us great in business, no matter what the business is. And you learn how to work as a team. Even though tennis is an individual sport, I still have a team. I got to work with my coach. Yeah. I got to work with my physio. I got to work with whomever it is. I got to work with whoever my practice partner is on the other side of the net to make sure that our drills are going properly, right? So, yeah, it's an individual sport when you're out there competing. But when you're training, it is teamwork. And so when you go into business, into the professional world outside of sport, or it could be business and sport, it's still working with a team and you're still driven to do and prepare. It's all about preparation.
Mm-hmm.
So for me to be the best on the court for my match, how well did I prepare? For me to do a presentation for, you know, some job or to get some deal, how well did I prepare? And I think that's what people are hiring or looking for in the qualities of individuals.
We only have about 30 seconds left here. Any predictions?
Here?
Yeah.
An American. Let's go.
On the men's side and the women's side?
Let's go. American.
All right.
Let's go.
You think so?
Let's go.
So we're back to, we are back to the 90s.
There era. We go.
We're
there
back
we go.
To the 90s
I hope so.
Era, at least
I
on
hope
the men's
so.
Side.
I hope so.
Do you still play?
I do. Very little, but I do.
Doubles, singles?
I just hit. I don't compete.
Just hit.
Well, I compete on the golf course.
Oh, that's right. Oh.
There we go.
Do you scream at yourself on the golf course?
I
too?
Absolutely do.
Okay, good. That's what I like to hear.
No, what we really want to know is, do you throw clubs? Well, you're definitely a hit, though, here. Thank you so much.
Awesome.
Good luck with everything.
Me. Thank
yeah.
you.
Katrina Adams, former president, chairman, CEO of the U.S. Tennis Association, former pro, so much more, so inspiring, and so much fun. Thank you so much. You're listening and watching Bloomberg Business Week.
Attention campers, the new Camp Snoopy at Kings Island brings your family summer camp fun all season long. Head to Camp Snoopy with Charlie Brown and the whole Peanuts gang for fun and adventure. Race forwards and backwards on the new family boomerang coaster, Snoopy Soapbox Racers. Explore on your own with more space to roam at Beagle Scout Acres. And don't forget to grab a snack at Pigpen's Mess Hall. It's a new way to play with the Peanuts gang at Camp Snoopy. Now open, only at Kings Island, for the fun of it.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Carol Masser, along with Tim Stenovic, live at the U.S. Open here in Flushing Meadow. Of course, we're just outside the Arthur Ashe Stadium. A lot going on, a lot of people, a lot of tournaments going on. It is like a perfect day.
Attendance record yesterday.
I wonder what today. I bet it'll be pretty good, too.
We'll find out at the toward the end of the day. Maybe it'll be another record.
All right. Well, one of the things, yeah, speaking of kind of getting to milestones, and a lot of it has to do with equality. When it comes to something like the game of sports, if you think about racial integration in professional sports overall, you often think about Jackie Robinson. In tennis, Althea Gibson really stands out. She grew up in Harlem, not far from where we are now. In 1956, she won what's now the French Open, becoming the first African-American to win a Grand Slam. She went on to win Wimbledon and what's now the U.S. Open.
She broke many barriers, and even though she was one of the most famous women in the world, her success on the court didn't translate to financial stability, especially later in life. Ashley Brown is an assistant professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She's written about the trials and triumphs of tennis champion Althea Gibson and her key role when it comes to the integration of American sports and, for a time, one of the most famous women in the world.
Yeah, Ashley Brown's book, is Own the Arena, Getting Ahead, Making a Difference, and Succeeding as the Only One. Out in 2021, she, Ashley Brown that is, joins us on Zoom from Madison, Wisconsin.
Serving herself.
Oh, did I say? Oh, what?
Yeah, that's okay. We were talking about, you know what, we got Katrina's book.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's Katrina. Okay. We got Serving Herself.
The Life and Times of Althea Gibson. I'm so sorry, Ashley. It's funny because we wanted Katrina to stay to kind of talk with you, and she said as she was leaving, great book, and the reason that there's a statue of Althea Gibson here is because of her when she was head of the USTA. Anyway, welcome, 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 and thank you so much for joining us. Tell us about your book.
Thanks so much for having me. So the book is Serving Herself, The Life and Times of Althea Gibson. It's a comprehensive, full-scale biography of Gibson, the first African-American to compete at what is now the U.S. Open, the first African-American to win at the U.S. Open, the first African-American to compete and also win titles at Wimbledon. And Gibson was also the first African-American woman to play on the LPGA tour. So she definitely broke through many barriers for many people and certainly for herself.
Ashley, what was the moment that you realized you wanted to write a book about this this person who broke so many barriers?
Well, I grew up in South Carolina, so I was well aware of Althea Gibson's success in tennis. But it was many years later, actually in my early years as an adult, I'm a golfer. In fact, I played 18 holes today, if you must know. And I remember deciding at that point that I wanted to learn more.
Not bad for a Thursday.
Yeah. I decided that I wanted to learn more about the history of golf, and I wanted to learn more about the history of African Americans in the game of golf. And I learned that Gibson was, again, the first African American woman to play on the LPGA Tour. And I thought, this woman broke barriers in tennis, and then she did so in golf. I really must learn more about Althea Gibson. And thus began a 10-year journey.
Wow, 10 years.
Tell us about that journey and some of the milestones in terms of learning more about her and the significance of her. Because it wasn't all always, a lot of it wasn't easy, to be fair.
No. To use a phrase, her life was certainly not all moonlight and magnolia. She had a hard time from the very beginning. She was the daughter of sharecroppers. The family joined the Great Migration. By the early 1930s, they were living in Harlem, which, of course, was a mecca for a number of people of African descent from around the world. The family was very poor. She was the oldest of five kids, and a great deal was expected of her. Gibson had a knack for coming to the attention of the right people at the right time. And in Harlem, people began to notice what an exceptional athlete she was. Pretty soon, she came to the attention of middle and upper class African Americans who loved the game of tennis. She excelled there, but of course, she also had to learn the ropes. She also had a number of difficulties when it came to class. So this is someone who broke barriers and who challenged the status quo when it came to gender, race, and class. And we certainly see that in terms of her success in tennis and golf. I'm fond of thinking of Gibson as certainly a Renaissance woman and someone who really refused to be held down. You know, there were a lot of people who said, no, you can't play tennis for this reason, you can't play golf for this reason, but she ignored those voices, and now she has such a rich legacy and, of course, the statue there on the grounds where you are in New York.
She has a rich legacy, but to be fair, she's not a household name. Mm-mm. I think for many people. Ashley, why do you think that is, given all the barriers she broke and all the firsts that she achieved?
It's a terrific point, Tim, and it's one of the reasons why I wrote this book. I certainly would name Jackie Robinson as one of my, I would say, personal heroes, but Gibson is up there too, and I want more people to be aware of her. I think there are a number of reasons. I think, first of all, it's because she played tennis. Tennis, for the longest time, has had an image as a niche sport, a sport that's associated with the well-to-do, the well-off. Even though there are a number of tennis champions, of course, who come from very humble backgrounds and beginnings, just like Gibson. And I also think the fact that she was a woman played into this. It's changing, but for most of its history in America, sport has really been seen as a male domain, a male preserve. And so when people think about champions, or when people have thought about champions, they've mostly looked to male athletes. And so I think gender was definitely in the way in terms of shrouding Gibson from the awareness of a number of people. But fortunately, thanks to the exploits of Gibson and a number of successful sportswomen and their allies, more attention is being focused on women in the history of sport. And it's really a terrific time now.
There was something that struck me, because I feel like in the aftermath of George Floyd, you know, we've had a lot of heart-to-heart conversations, certainly with Black colleagues that we work with, and just, you know, this idea of being often a token in an event or a conference room or a meeting or something, and the burden that is put on their shoulders to kind of be that one individual, you know, that's maybe speaking, or people are looking at them as speaking for their race overall. And in your book, you say Althea was frustrated by the ways in which race saddled her with labor unknown to her white colleagues on the tennis circuit, having to contend with crowds hostile to me because of my color, with newspaper men demanding twice as much of me as they did of anybody else simply because my color made me more newsworthy, and even with powerful governments seeking to use me as an instrument of national policy because of my color, seemed to me to be more than anybody should have to bear. That's pretty powerful.
Those are aptly chosen words, Carol. Those words actually come from Althea Gibson's first memoir. And she often found herself in the very difficult position of being expected to be a role model, of being expected to be a spokesperson for African Americans. This is a great opportunity to remind viewers and listeners of the times when Gibson lived and when she carried out her career. She was born in 1927, and she made her, and for that matter, African Americans' debut at what is now the U.S. Open in 1950. She won the French Open in 1956, Wimbledon, and the U.S. Open in 57, and repeated in 58. Anyone who has any awareness of history is aware that those were key moments in the build-up toward and launching into the civil rights movement. 1963, when she turns to professional golf, that, of course, is the moment when we have the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. And so many people expected Althea Gibson to speak up and to stand up for all African Americans. That's quite a bit of pressure. And it's also quite a bit of pressure when, at the same time, she was trying to make sure that she had things for herself and that she could support and help her own family at the same time that she's dealing with discrimination because of her race and because of her gender. So this history tells us so much more about just the challenges African Americans across the country had, but also more specifically the challenges that this particular African American woman had in the games of golf and tennis, but also when it came to getting endorsements and really getting a foothold into commercial and the business aspects of America.
We're still talking with Ashley Brown. She's assistant professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Her new book, published earlier this year, Serving Herself, The Life and Times of Althea Gibson, still with us on Zoom from Madison, Wisconsin. Hey, Ashley, one thing I'm curious about, we want to dig a little bit more into the book, but after doing all the research and work, did you like Althea? Did you have a takeaway on her?
I did like her. And I would say that my first among many takeaways was really the importance of perseverance. Althea Gibson never gave up, and she gave all of herself to everything that she did, every endeavor. Even when it seemed that the world was against her, she refused to be denied, she refused to go away, and she just kept pushing and going. And I think that's the ultimate takeaway that I want readers to have when they pick up and when they finish the book.
Ashley, why did she not find commercial success, especially toward the end of her life? I mean, this is a woman who, you write, was at one point one of the most famous people in the world. She was on the cover of magazines. Look, you know, information didn't travel as quickly as it does now in the 1950s, but she was winning Grand Slams. What happened?
She won Grand Slams, and as you point out, she was on the covers of magazines all around the world. But she also often seemed to be a step too late, a step behind. So Gibson turned to professional tennis in 1959. It's only in 1968 that we get the open era in tennis, meaning that amateurs and professionals could compete in the same tournaments, including the Grand Slams. And this also meant that at last people could be, players could be paid and paid well, openly, for what they did. This eluded Gibson in her time. And though she did play in a few professional events in the late 1960s and early 1970s, by this time she's in her early 40s. She's not at the peak of her game anymore. And so in terms of her athleticism and being able to cash in, that just never happened. And then also, when we think about her professional golf career, certainly there's a tremendous imbalance in terms of the purses in the men's tournaments and the women's tournaments. The women always made less than the men in professional golf. Gibson was also hampered by the fact that she came to golf much later than most of the people who played on the LPGA Tour. Many of those women had played since they were in their early teens or even younger. Gibson had dabbled in golf before the late 1950s, when she became serious about it. But she was really behind the eight ball, we might say, compared to the other women who were on the circuit. So she was never able to really make the money in either tennis or golf that she would have hoped. And then finally, Because she was behind, she was also behind athletically in those sports in terms of the pro ranks. But this also meant that corporate America was not really open to her because really at this time, segregation and discrimination were rampant on the American business scene in the 1950s and the 1960s. And so a number of companies she felt were reluctant to hire her to endorse their products. And so she wasn't able to make the kind of money of, let's say, Arthur Ashe, as you point out, or Reggie Jackson in the 1970s. And certainly nothing compared to the amounts of money that athletes today are able to make, not only on their teams and in their individual sports, but also commercially.
Well, you talk about in the book, this was, I think, in the 1970 or at 1970, Gibson taking a long, hard look at her finances and faced a sobering reality long in the making. She recounted the realization years later, quote, "You got to eat, you got to pay the rent, you got to pay bills, car insurance, and things like that. I wasn't making enough money to do that." There's several sections in your book where you talk about financial concerns. Tim and I, we've just got about a couple of minutes left. We're curious about your process of putting this together. And, you know, before I cracked open the book, Tim was like, you got to go to also the pictures that are in there because it really, in a strong way, tells so much of her story as so. But talk to us a little bit about the process.
Long process, 10 years in the making. Also a very personal process. Certainly I enjoy tennis, and I'll be paying attention to the Open and what Coco Gauff and Caroline Wozniacki are doing. But also writing the sections about her golf career, I wanted to make sure that that received the attention that it deserved because I felt that that was a part of her life and her legacy that really had not received adequate attention. But this was also about searching through archives, looking at all kinds of correspondence, federal records and government records at the state and other levels. Her fame was really useful because this meant that Gibson was someone who, from a very early age, traveled across the country and around the world. So going through hundreds of newspapers and magazines and reading through thousands of articles to get a sense of where she went and what she did, what she said, and also what people thought of her. And so this is why the book is as long as it is, and it's also why the story, the narrative, why they are as deep and as engaging as they are.
Just in the last 20 seconds we have, do students get to take a class on her from you?
They don't get to take a class that is specifically about Althea Gibson, but I certainly talk about her in my large lecture course, History 136, Sport, Recreation, and Society, and also in another lecture course that I teach that is also very, very popular called African Americans in Sports. Fine. And we'll certainly talk about very Gibson cool. this fall in my seminar, which is about women in United States sports history.
Well, we said to you, Katrina Adams, former president of the USTA, she said, great book, incredible book. Ashley, thank you so much. Assistant professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, her new book, Serving Herself, The Life and Times of Althea Gibson. It is out. She called it long. I call it comprehensive, and it means you learn something. This is Bloomberg.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Attention campers, the new Camp Snoopy at Kings Island brings your family summer camp fun all season long. Head to Camp Snoopy with Charlie Brown and the whole Peanuts gang for fun and adventure. Race forwards and backwards on the new family boomerang coaster, Snoopy Soapbox Racers. Explore on your own with more space to roam at Beagle Scout Acres. And don't forget to grab a snack at Pigpen's Mess Hall. It's a new way to play with the Peanuts gang at Camp Snoopy. Now open, only at Kings Island, for the fun of it.